This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. How do you become a women's rights activist? How are you even exposed to the idea that women deserve equal rights after you've grown up in a tribal region of Pakistan where girls don't even go to school? My guest, Khalid Abrohi, is going to tell us her story. She spent part of her childhood in a remote Pakistani village where people lived in huts made of mud. In keeping with tribal tradition, her mother was forced into marriage at the age of 9. Brohi was nearly promised to a man before she was even born. Her cousin was a victim of an honor killing at age 14, murdered by her uncle because she'd married out of love instead of marrying the man she was arranged to marry. Brohi's father believed in education, and as a result, she became the first girl in her village to go to school. After being exposed to books and ideas, as well as to the suffering of girls and women in her village, she dedicated herself to educating women, helping them understand they deserve to be treated with honor too, that they have the right to education, and that men in the family do not have the right to murder their wives and daughters. She's launched several nonprofits and now divides her time between the U.S. and Pakistan. She's written a new memoir called I Should Have Honor. Khalid Abrohi, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to start just with a definition. What is an honor killing?
An honor killing is defined in many ways, but to me, it's an ego killing. It's to restore men's honor. It's something where women and men were both killed in the name of honor if they were found having relationships outside of marriage or before marriage. Now, these days, it's also used as a business where women are killed and the man is spared and he pays money for his life. So in many cases, if someone wants to pay a big debt, they would target a woman in their family and then call out to a man who has money and say that if you don't pay, we would kill you as well because we know that you were in a relationship with our sister or this family member.
Well, so there's people hunting down people in relationships so that they can make a profit on it.
These days, in many places, it is like that, sadly.
So your cousin was the victim of an honor killing. What had she done that was considered worthy of the death penalty?
My cousin had fallen in love. In those times, it was made to look very, very wrong in our eyes.
When you say in those days, it wasn't that long ago. How long ago was it?
It was more than 10 years ago, and I was a teenager, and she was a teenager, and we were friends, and we would play dolls, and I would watch her read and have this love for writing. She wrote poems as well. But there was a gossip in the village that because she goes to school, she's learned how to write. She's now writing love poems. There was this tendency to accuse women to use their freedom and education against their culture immediately as soon as they were free, even slightly. And for Khadija, it was a very, very common gossip in the village that she's writing love poems and she is going to go against her family. So everybody was very much against her before even she had these feelings of love for someone. And she was caught and murdered by my uncle.
So she and her boyfriend had hid to protect themselves.
She and her husband. She had
they
left
were already
to
married.
Marry
uh-huh.
this. Yes. Mm-hmm. She had left to marry this person she loved very much. And she was already engaged to someone in the family. But she'd already had feelings for this boy. And so when they left, within a week of their departure, my uncle sent out people to every bus station, every road, and they would be waiting there to look for her and that boy. And when they found her, the boy's family immediately arrived so they could save him. But Khadija was taken back to Kotri, where we used to live at that time. And she was, within just a week, she was murdered.
And describe how she was murdered.
This is the second case of honor killings in my life. At that time, I have witnessed about three, but this was the second one, and it was the most devastating because by the time I found out about her, she had already died. They'd already buried her, and she was long gone. When she was found out, they put her in a house until a decision was made. And no matter how long they take, the usual decision in the end is murder. So one day her sister came to visit her, her sister Kulsoom, who's also my childhood friend, and they both cried about what had been happening. And she asked Kulsoom, "What is the punishment they've chosen for me? My father has chosen for me." And Kulsoom tells me that I just looked at her because I knew that she knew. When she was asking me, she knew she was going to be murdered. And just like that, within 2 or 3 days, 3 men arrived and they took her, walked for hours, taken to a place where her grave was already dug. And she was murdered by my uncle right there.
It's so unimaginable that a father would take the life of his daughter because she was with the man who she loved and who also loved her. I can't comprehend it.
I know. When I found out, I couldn't comprehend it either. So the poems that I used to compose, the poems that started me to the path of activism, usually had this girl who would ask questions, especially to her father. How can you do this? I have this poem that I wrote in which I read it in the news that a girl was sleeping in the farms, in the agriculture fields outside, and her father came and dragged her from there and killed her in his axe that he was using to chop the agriculture fields. And she shouted and yelled, and it happened because she had fallen asleep outside of her home. She had fallen asleep out in public, which is somehow dishonoring to him. And so I had also thought about that girl and imagined her and the questions she would be asking, and composed a poem in which she's asking her father, "How can the same hands be cradling me when I'm an infant? How can they now raise with such anger and hate towards me?" I'm still wondering that to this day.
Can you read an excerpt of that poem for us?
Yes, definitely.
And when did you write this?
I think I wrote this in 2006.
So that would be shortly after your cousin's murder.
This was 3 years later, yeah.
Okay.
3 to 4 years. "I woke at once when I felt being dragged. I saw you, and for mercy I begged. Seized I was in your hands. I was a sinner. I slept on open lands. The hands that cradled me once before, to me they belong to you no more. My heart stopped just at that time, and I was killed for an unknown crime."
Thanks for reading that. I should say here, for people just joining us, that you've become an activist trying to educate and organize women in Pakistan to stand up for their rights and to comprehend that they are equal to men. And I think I just, you know, have such respect for you for taking such tragedy in your own life and for looking at the rights unavailable to you and to other women. And instead of shrinking, to grow larger and to do everything that you can to change things, putting your own life at risk. When your cousin was the victim of an honor killing at the hands of your uncle, her father, what about her mother? How did her mother respond to it?
The saddest part about the story is that it wasn't her father. It was also her uncle. This was our eldest uncle.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And her father had just consented about this decision. The delay in her murder was because he was reluctant. He had allowed her to go to school, and Khadija was very much loved. She was a very good person. She would smile all the time, and she was always social and talked to people. She had such a aliveness to her. Whenever we would look at her, we would just think about life flourishing. And to think of her as gone was, that's why it was such a big shock. But her father had hesitated for many days, and finally he had given in. But within 3 years of the murder, he had a heart attack in the middle of the night, and he passed away. And just like that, the mother also passed away because of cancer. She kept telling everyone that, this is very hard for me to speak about, but when she was murdered, the boy's family had pleaded them to take money instead of murdering him, and the money would bring food to the table of this family, and the mother would refuse to eat. And because there was nothing else to eat, they would force her to have a few bites. And one day she ate from that food, and the next day she said, "I feel a cancer growing in me because I ate my daughter."
Gee, do you want to take a moment? Your mother, and you tell this story in your book, your mother at the age of 9 was married off. And what were the circumstances behind that?
This story is actually one of the most interesting to us. At the same time, it's the most sad, because the way it happened was a very, very big shock, and my mother didn't really open up about it until very recently. She was 9 years old when she was living in Balochistan with her siblings. She had a beautiful life as a child. Even though in those villages, the young girls end up being very adult at the age of 9. They're taking care of the house, they're cooking for the family, they're washing and cleaning and helping with the mother. So she was pretty much an adult, but at the same time, she loved climbing trees. She loved running around with her friends. She was this happy, positive person who enjoyed the life of an indigenous tribal society. One day, she remembers that her father comes in the morning. He comes through the door, and he's like, "We are all going to Sindh province." And she'd always wanted to go to Sindh. She'd always dreamed of this land. Everybody talks about how green it is, how beautiful the lush trees and fruits. And they had a lot of relatives in Sindh. So she got ready with a great joy. She got her siblings ready, helped her mother, and they left, and that was the start of her new life. She had no idea that while her father had announced that they're just going to visit the relatives in Sindh, he had already said yes to her marriage in an exchange into those villages, and she was not to come back to her home. She says that if she was ever told that, she would have said goodbye to many people. She would have said goodbye to the street that she played in and the tree she climbed on. And this is the most saddest part for her.
Your father was 13 at the time.
Yes.
And he didn't want to be in an exchange marriage either. Why didn't he want to be in one?
My father has a very interesting story. When he was born, he says that from the time he started speaking or he was able to think, he loved thinking. He loved to think about what was outside of that village. It was a tiny little mud village, mud houses and small fields, and they didn't even own the fields. The landlords did. So they would work for some other people, and he became a shepherd. And one day when he was 4 years old, he was taking the sheep. He was thinking to himself about the world and about how is it possible that there is so many other things outside of this village. And his thoughts just went through the whole day. And at night, when evening fall, both of them looked at the sheep, and the sheep were lying on the fields, not moving. He went to check what happened, and turns out the sheep had overgrazed on alfalfa, and they were very much bloated. So they called out for anyone to help. Their father came, my grandfather, and somehow nobody was able to save the sheep, and this was very expensive mistake for the family. The neighborhood people survived on the milk of that sheep and the income from that. So he disgraced the whole family. And as a punishment, his father sent him to school, because school is the place where boys go because they can't earn any income. And somehow he became the first man, first boy in that tribe to be educated, who discovered what an incredible treasure it is. And that's how he became the person who he is today.
A part of the story I really love about your parents' marriage, when your mother was 9 and your father was 13, your father, because he loved education so much, and he wanted an educated wife, he wanted somebody who he could talk to about the things that he learned, who could also read, and so he had decided to educate your mother, and your mother found that she loved reading. And it's really, considering the circumstances, it's such a beautiful story.
Thank you. It is a beautiful story. It shaped the family to become who we are and to give us the paths that we chose, because when he made it to university, he started realizing the injustices even more. He had started thinking about women's rights and about the position he would one day give to his daughters. At the time of university, he discovered that his village not only had given him opportunity to go to school, but at the same time had also made him suffer by putting him through this tragic exchange marriage to a girl he had not met and everything. And at that time, my mother was 9 and he was 13. By this time, he was about 16 or 17, and he said, "I'm going to marry someone else." So when he went to college, he saw a girl, and he was like, "I can't believe this girl not only goes to school, she likes talking about politics. She reads books." This was astonishing to him. And so he decided that he's going to finally find someone who's worth him and marry that girl. But when he was about to reach out to the family of that girl to ask for her hand in marriage, he remembered the time when my mother came to him as a bride. The night when he walked into that room, it was a dark room, the first night of their marriage. My mother was sitting on a cot, decorated like a doll, with clothes from someone else, jewelry hanging off of her, her makeup all smeared because she'd been crying. And he remembered how much she was shaking. She was so scared, that 9-year-old girl who only wanted to go back to her mother. And he was like, "That was not her fault. If education is what I love about a woman, I'm going to go and educate her, and I'm sure I would love her." And so he did. And they fall in love, and they were the biggest love story of the village.
It's a beautiful story that has a really bad beginning.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, your father believed in education for himself. He believed in education for your mother. He believed in education for you. Were you the first girl in your village to go to school?
Yes. My father, I'm always grateful to him for educating me. But more than that, I'm grateful to him for teaching me about honor. When I was very little, he asked me to come and sit next to him. And he was like, "Do you know how you will dishonor me?" And instantly, I was so scared, because I'd been hearing all these stories about girls who had dishonored their fathers and the punishments they had received. By that time, I did not know about honor killings, but I knew that it's the biggest disgrace you could do for your family. And I knew that somehow my responsibility was attached to my father. So I was the only person, or the first person, who could dishonor him. I didn't say anything. And he said, "You would dishonor me by bringing bad grades from school." He shifted everything for me. He told me that honor can be chosen for a person individually, whatever it means to them. All my life, I had known that honor was something associated with men, about women. If women went out to the markets, they dishonored their fathers. If they studied, they dishonored their fathers. If they didn't wear their scarf, or if they laughed loudly, they dishonored their fathers. But this was new. If I didn't study hard, or if I didn't bring good grades, I would dishonor him. And that really, really relieved me. It empowered me so much that I worked really hard in the school. And when time came for me to speak up against honor killings when my cousin was murdered, I was ready.
Khaled Abrohi's new memoir is called I Should Have Honor. We did take a pause there before resuming, so let's take a short break in our show. Then we'll hear more of my interview with Khaled Abrohi, her new memoir about growing up in Pakistan and becoming a women's rights activist working against honor killings and exchange marriages is called I Should Have Honor. And film critic David Edelstein will review Blaze, directed by Ethan Hawke. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Rhodes Scholar, offering a six-day program this fall on the campus of Cornell University that teaches debating skills to adults 50+. Learn more at roadscholar.org/debate. And from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Khaled Abrohi. Her new memoir is about growing up in the tribal area of Pakistan. She was the first girl in her village to go to school. Her cousin was the victim of an honor killing at age 14 because she married out of love, defying the plan for her arranged marriage. Abrohi became a women's rights activist, trying to help women stand up for their rights and stand up against murdering wives and daughters who defy the men of the family. She now divides her time between the U.S. and Pakistan. Her new memoir is called I Should Have Honor. Our film critic David Edelstein has a review of the new movie Blaze, directed and co-written by Ethan Hawke. It's about the Texas-raised country singer-songwriter Blaze Foley, and it's based on a memoir by Foley's ex-partner, Sybil Rosen. It stars musicians Ben Dickey and Charlie Sexton, with Aaliyah Shawkat as Rosen. Before we hear David's review, let's listen to a bit of the real Foley singing his song, Clay Pigeons.
I'd like to stay, but I might have to go to start over again. Might go back down to Texas, I might go to somewhere I never been. And get up in the morning, go out at night, and I won't have to go home. Get used to being alone, change your words to the song, start singing again.
Blaze Foley. The voice sounds familiar, even if you've never heard it. It's the timbre, the ache, that doesn't slow the song, as if to say, look how sad I am, but drives it. Blaze Foley was one of those artists who, however unruly his life, could center himself in his writing and playing long enough to sit in judgment on himself. That's what the director Ethan Hawke and the star Ben Dickey capture in Blaze. And whatever else they miss, it's more than enough. Dickey is a musician who's never acted before. Although he doesn't have that iconic country baritone, he makes you believe he wrote Foley's songs. He talks to us through them.
I'd like to stay, but I might have to go to start over again.
I might go back to Texas, might go to some place where I've never been. Get up in the morning and go out at night, and I won't have to come home. Get used to being alone. Change the words to this song and start singing again.
When Dickie performs, the movie is great. Hawk plainly loves hanging out with him. The way musicians, Hawk is one too, sit around for hours, playing, talking, drinking. Cinematographer Steve Kozins frames shots in ways that seem loose, but capture both the grain of a place and its aura, how it seeps into people. Throughout the film, Hawk keeps returning to Foley's last show at Austin's legendary Outhouse Bar, where he's at the end of his tether, but not, even whiskey-addled, his talent. Sadly, the rest of Blaze doesn't have that simplicity. It has fancy pants technique. It's a flashback full of flash forwards and a limited vantage, that of Sybil Rosen, who co-wrote the screenplay with Hawk. Rosen met Foley in 1975 while working as an actress in a Georgia artist community, and she lived with him in the woods in a treehouse, hence her 2008 memoir's title, Living in a Woods in a Tree, Remembering Blaze Foley. Early on, Rosen, played by frizzy-haired Aaliyah Shawkat, gets to know Dickie's big, bearded Blaze, and you feel their goofy rapport, though Dickie's diction is on the muddy side.
So you're going to be a big country star, like Roger Miller?
Huh?
I don't want to be a star. I want to be a legend.
Well, what's the difference, Debbie?
Well, stars burn out because they shine for themselves. Look at me shine. Look at me glow. I'm amazing. Legend lasts forever.
Aaliyah Shawkat is an excellent actress, and she shores up the novice actor Ben Dickie the way I imagine Sybil Rosen shored up Blaze. That's how Rosen presents it anyway. She and director Ethan Hawke view Foley's life as a struggle between two poles, the nurturing life force symbolized by that treehouse and the death-driven road where Foley wanted to be a legend, falling in with the drug-fueled singer-songwriter Towns Van Zandt. Van Zandt is played in Blaze by the charismatic musician Charlie Sexton, and in one of the film's threads, he tells stories about Foley to a clueless radio host, played by Hawk, seen only from behind. Van Zandt insists musicians need to turn their backs on their families and find a sphere apart, to the point of courting chaos. This is not, however, a film about the romance of self-destruction. If anything, it goes too far in the opposite direction, so that Foley and Van Zandt seem rudderless. Their scenes together are blurry, dull. They don't spark each other. Dickie's Foley is soft. While other characters allude to his frightening temper, he's more like a wayward teddy bear, fated to stagger into a trap. Meanwhile, Hawk's syntax, the jumps from the Austin Outhouse concert to Van Zandt's radio interview to life in the treehouse and back, muddles the momentum. He even inexplicably jumps forward and back within scenes. He's like a film student fiddling around in the editing room, and he makes a hash of the events leading up to Foley's violent death. The magic in Blaze is when time stops. In one scene, Foley, Rosen, and Foley's sister, played by the musician Alindra Segarra, visit Foley's once-abusive near-senile father, played by Kris Kristofferson. When Foley and his sister sing a sad, sweet duet for the old man, you can imagine Kristofferson hearing it on two levels, as the now childlike father, and also the singer-songwriter who knew the real Foley, Van Zandt, and other musicians who burned themselves out, supposedly for art's sake. That's what Ethan Hawke accomplishes in Blaze, for all his silly directorial stutter steps. He makes you believe in the power of music to summon ghosts. ¶¶
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. After we take a short break, we'll hear from former Senator and Secretary of State John Kerry. He has a new memoir. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
$20 bill and probably ain't enough to get me through election day. Didn't I hear you say it's all right, it's all right? Wouldn't even weigh a thing, it's hardly worth your time. And my luck's been bad, the telephone just kept my only dime, and there might be a burglary. Why don't you just go and see? I'll be all right, I'll be all right.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is John Kerry. He's written a new memoir, and in reviewing his life, he gets to issues that are central to politics today, like the use of falsehoods in American politics, and how during his presidential campaign, falsehoods were used to smear both his character and his record of service in Vietnam, and how as Secretary of State, he was instrumental in the nuclear agreement with Iran, the Paris Climate Accord, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, only to have President Trump pull out of each of them. He writes about how he became friends with John McCain, even though Kerry opposed the war in Vietnam while McCain was a POW. Kerry even considered inviting McCain to be his vice presidential running mate. Kerry served 5 terms as a U.S. Senator from Boston and became Secretary of State under President Obama in 2013, following Hillary Clinton's departure. His new memoir is called Every Day is Extra, a reference to the gift of life after surviving the war in Vietnam. We started by talking about a turning point in the use of falsehoods to smear a political opponent, the Swiftboat campaign against him during his 2004 run for president. Swiftboats were designed for shallow water and were used by the U.S. Navy for patrolling the coast of Vietnam during the war. Kerry commanded swiftboat missions and was injured in one of them. The swiftboat campaign against him included a series of ads and a book saying that Kerry didn't deserve his service medals and that he'd lied about the swiftboat mission in which they were ambushed. John Kerry, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to start with the swiftboat campaign against you, which you write about in your memoir. And I want to start here because it's a turning point in how lies, falsehoods that are demonstrably untrue can be used effectively against a candidate. So before we talk about the falsehoods, let's talk about the reality of what happened on your Swift boat, the mission that people were talking about when they were trying to call you a liar.
In the early spring of 2004, a book came out by Doug Brinkley called Tour of Duty, which was a book about my service in Vietnam, and a small group of veterans who disagreed with some of the characterizations by Doug Brinkley, not me, rebelled against it and attacked me for it. He used it as a vehicle to try to attack me. It was led by a guy who had actually appeared in my life way back in the anti-war days, 1971, who had acted on behalf of the White House, the Nixon White House, and attacked back then. But this time they did it by major distortions in the record. And initially our campaign pushed back against it and corrected the record. My military record spoke very directly to what had happened. The people who are actually on the boats involved in these ambushes in Vietnam, in these attacks and incidents, spoke to it. But that didn't stop them. They had a strategy. Their strategy was simply to provide alternative facts, to make them up, much in the vernacular that we see today. And we answered that as forcefully as we could. We released my military records. We had people speak who were there. And the major media of the nation carried it. So in the campaign, our advisors believed we had adequately, quote, answered. The problem was that the right wing got behind this with major funding from some of the very same names who are doing major right-wing funding in the country today. And they started to pick up on these alternative facts and push them out there in the context of advertisements, television advertisements.
I'm going to stop you there because I want to play one of the ads. So this is one of the anti-John Kerry ads used in the 2004 presidential campaign, in which veterans speak, calling Kerry a liar for what he said and what others said, what the official records had said he'd done as the leader in a Swift boat mission.
If you have any question about what John Kerry's made up, just spend 3 minutes with the men who served with him.
I served with John Kerry.
I served with John Kerry.
John Kerry has not been honest about what happened in Vietnam.
He is lying about his record.
I know John Kerry is lying about his first Purple Heart because I treated him for that injury.
John Kerry lied to get his Bronze Star. I know. I was there. I saw what happened.
His account of what happened and what actually happened are the difference between night and day.
John Kerry has not been honest.
And he lacks the capacity to lead.
When the chips were down, you could not count on John Kerry.
John Kerry is no war hero.
He betrayed all his shipmates. He lied before the Senate.
John Kerry betrayed the men and women he served with in Vietnam.
He dishonored his country. He most certainly did.
I served with John Kerry. John Kerry cannot be trusted.
Swift Boat Veterans for Truth is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
Okay, I want to specifically ask you about one of the men there who says, I know John Kerry is lying about his first Purple Heart because I treated him for that injury. Who was that?
I don't remember his name. It might have been the doctor or the aide, I forget which, who was in the Cameron Bay medical facility where they took the shrapnel out of my arm. But I don't think there was any discussion about what happened with him. He would not have known. He wasn't there. He wasn't on the mission. All he did was take the piece of metal out of my arm. That was his job. And I don't know what he's referring to in terms of what he knows or doesn't know. But the simple bottom line is we were in a very small boat, three of us at night, and we took enemy under fire. And in the course of that, that's when I got a piece of shrapnel in my arm. And I had nothing to do with, you know, quote, getting a first a Purple Heart or even the Bronze Star. I mean, I listened to that just again now, and somebody said I lied about, quote, getting a Bronze Star. I didn't even know I was getting a Bronze Star. The recommendation came from an Army captain that I pulled out of the water who weeks after I left Vietnam, apparently put me in for the medal. So, I mean, they just made things up. They made them up right, left, and center. And when people said, I served with John Kerry, that means they served in swift boats. But it didn't mean they were on my boat. It didn't mean they were on the mission. It didn't mean they knew what had happened. And they weren't in those cases. And the guys who were contradicted them. So what they did was they just built this up with little phrases. Skillfully done as an attack ad, obviously. I remember being in Ohio and listening to that ad, and I called my campaign headquarters and said, guys, I just heard an ad, and if I heard that ad, I wouldn't vote for me.
So I want to talk with you about something that you actually did say, but that the message was used against you, also in a way that we see done today. You returned from the war opposing it because so much of the war just seems senseless to you. And the South Vietnamese who we were supposed to be defending, you say, didn't seem to want us there. They just wanted to live in peace. So when you came home, you became one of the leaders of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. You delivered testimony to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which years later you ended up chairing. You delivered testimony in 1971 based in part on your experiences and based in part on the experiences of other vets who you'd heard testify at a meeting in Detroit. And I want to just play a bit of your testimony about atrocities that had been described by vets who committed them and now were deeply regretful about it.
It's impossible to describe to you exactly what did happen in Detroit, the emotions in the room, the feelings of the men who were reliving their experiences in Vietnam. But they did. They relived the absolute horror of what this country, in a sense, made them do. They told the stories of times that they had personally raped, cut off ears, cut off heads, taped wires from portable telephones to human genitals and turned up the power, cut off limbs, blown up bodies, randomly shot at civilians, razed villages in a fashion reminiscent of Genghis Khan, shot cattle and dogs for fun, poisoned food stocks, and generally ravaged the countryside of South Vietnam.
So that testimony was used against you by people saying, he's saying what the enemy, what the Viet Cong, what the North Vietnamese want him to say, because this is exactly the kind of thing they're trying to get prisoners of war, American prisoners of war, to say that they'd committed these atrocities. So that statement kind of haunted you through your career because of the way it was used against you. So in retrospect, looking back at that and on its impact on the anti-war movement, and it had a very positive impact on the anti-war movement, what are your thoughts about what you said and how you said it and the impact it had on your life and the impact it had on the war?
Well, Terry, I think that if you, as you just played, my voice has come and I was recounting what they had said, what their agony was. Mm-hmm. I was recounting something that happened in America, that these veterans, each of whom produced what is called their DD-214, their discharge papers that indicated what unit they were in and where they served and when and so forth, and that they were honorably discharged. And these were people who were undergoing great difficulties, as many veterans did when they came home from Vietnam. I mean, people forget that. We've lost more veterans of Vietnam to self-medication, to alcohol abuse, drug abuse, to, you know, wrecked lives, than there are names on the wall in the Vietnam Memorial in Washington. And this was what happened to certain numbers of people in certain places at certain times. It wasn't everywhere. And I made that clear. But people just didn't like, I mean, there was a truth that was difficult to deal with. And It was a sad byproduct to some degree of a lot of young guys running around at a time of great cultural and social turbulence when military discipline to some degree broke down in Vietnam.
So I think it's interesting that you, who became an outspoken anti-war activist, and John McCain, who was a prisoner of war for 5 years, and emerged from that with physical problems. He was never able to lift his arms. That you became friends, and in fact, when you were running in 2004 for president, you had considered inviting him to be a running mate. John McCain was also the victim of a smear when he was running in the presidential primary. And in South Carolina, there was a whisper campaign saying that he had fathered a child with a black prostitute. In fact, John McCain...
It was a terrible campaign.
Yeah, and John McCain, in fact, did have a black child who he adopted from Bangladesh. But these things, even when they're not true, they make an impression on people. It's like, I don't know about that John McCain. But I'm wondering, if you were disappointed in McCain when he had Sarah Palin, who is, I don't know if you want to call her a climate change skeptic or denier, as his vice presidential running mate. She also spread a lot of falsehoods about vaccinations and about death panels. There will be death panels if Obama is elected and we have his health care reform. So were you disappointed in the choice?
Well, I was surprised by the choice. It wasn't up to me to be disappointed, but I was surprised, obviously, by the choice. But I think John did what he did to win the nomination, obviously. I think it was I was disappointed that he couldn't acknowledge that, climate change was happening because of human beings and so forth, that his party had created a new orthodoxy of almost every single candidate had to say that they didn't accept the idea that climate change was real. That's a sad commentary on American politics when all of our scientists, 98-99% of scientists, and it's a settled issue that human beings are contributing to it. So I think John was disappointed in his own choice later on, and obviously, Sarah Palin was not invited to his funeral, and I think that makes its own statement about how John McCain felt about it later on. But John and I managed to find, I write about this in the book at length because it mattered to me. One of the most important conversations I ever had in the Senate was the one I had on an airplane flying to Kuwait with John McCain when we really began to decide to work together to try to make a difference. And ultimately, John McCain and I went back to Vietnam together on this quest to try to find the answers on POWs and MIA. And I stood alone in the Hanoi Hilton with John McCain in the very cell in which he had spent several years of his life as a prisoner. And it was one of the most remarkable moments I've ever had in my life, to stand there, this conservative Republican, prisoner of war, war hero, with this guy who protested the war and obviously came from a different place on it. And yet we found common ground in a prison cell in Hanoi.
Politics is not just a balancing act when it comes to getting elected and staying in office and all the balancing you have to do as Secretary of State. There's the balancing of the personal and the political when you're in office or Secretary of State, and you've been confronted with major events happening on both sides at the same time. So, for instance, right after one of your presidential debates, your first wife, the mother of your two daughters, her cancer had returned. It had spread through her body, and you knew that she was dying. And you had to continue with the campaign and all the preparation, knowing that was happening. Your wife, Teresa, had a major seizure while you were Secretary of State. And she was hospitalized initially in critical condition and had to take medication to prevent future seizures. She needed 24-hour attention in case she had another seizure, in case she fell. And, of course, you had to continue with your work as Secretary of State, although she was not able to travel with you because of her medical condition. If you could just speak a little bit about the difficulty of having any kind of personal life at all and of being true to your family while also doing the job that you know you need to do in public life when you have the career that you had. So if you could just address that a little bit, I'd love to hear how you've tried to balance that in your life.
Frankly, I've never found it hard and difficult. Maybe sometimes I've failed to balance it. Who knows? Others will judge that. But I've been blessed with extraordinary family. My daughters are incredible. My wife is incredible. I'm lucky. I mean, that's why Every Day is Extra is the title of my book. It's something that we talked about in Vietnam. Those of us lucky to come back and be alive when others didn't, you got to look at life like every day is extra and be happy about it, because a lot of guys didn't come back. And that's the baseline, if you will. And you don't have to go to war to feel that way. You escape cancer, you escape an accident, whatever it is that happens, I view myself as lucky.
Secretary Kerry, thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure entirely, and thank you very much, Terry.
John Kerry's new memoir is called Every Day is Extra. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.